Has everybody got this announcement about the travel vouchers and the change of time and the boat trip? Okay, I'll stick that over here for a little while.
What did the stock market do?
Stock market, last time I checked, which is about 30 minutes ago, was up about 7 points. GM reported good earnings. Microsoft and IBM rebounded slightly.
But this is still down 50 for the conference?
We were up 50 on the first day, lost 50 on the second day, lost 70 on the third day, up 7 a day. Hey, life's a random walk. Actually, I don't believe the random walk hypothesis at all. Okay, well, here's the goal. One of the facts that I mentioned earlier was that Ree was able to obtain the exact constant for large, in the sense of large D, for the traveling salesman problem. So you remember that there was a constant defined as beta sub TSP of D, which was the limit almost yearly or in expectation of the length of the TSP tour for endpoints chosen at random from the unit D cube. And Ree's result is that that constant differs from this interesting ratio by an amount which is of lower order. They're quite substantially lower order. Okay. All right. Last time we expressed the same result in terms of a B of D divided by the square root of D that normalizes by the diagonal of the unit D cubed, which is a natural length for the problem. Well, we're going to prove this. And the proof has several interesting features. It has a new algorithm for the TSP. It also reminds us of something of the geometry of balls in RD, and the fact that in dimension one, the difference between the unit ball and the unit square is pretty negligible. They've got almost the same geometry. In dimension two, the difference between them is still quite modest. Okay, although it's easier to see. In dimension 100, these things become so radically different that a technique that's appropriate for the cube could be drastically wrong and inappropriate for the sphere. And Talleyrand takes advantage of that in the analysis of a matching theorem for arbitrary norms, or reasonably arbitrary norms. So let n be any old norm on RD. Then what Talleyrand proves for large D, actually for the statement of the theorem, you only need that D be greater than or equal to 3, but that the lim sup of the minimum matching, where the cost of the matching is measured by the norm of the difference between the XI and the best match, normalized by the characteristic growth rate. You recall that for D 3 or bigger, we don't have that square root of log term anymore, is bounded by a constant which is just the volume of the unit ball in RD, where the ball is determined by the norm. So the ball is the set of all of those values x that have norm less than or equal to 1. And it's, a well-known hobby trying to compute the volumes of such balls. And a small error term. Okay. So that's Talleyrand's theorem, and that'll play a pivotal role and determination of Ree's theorem. Okay, so that's the plan. That's a, well, arbitrary, it's a permutation invariant norm. I think permutation invariant is all that I need. So that'd be symmetric. It doesn't even include all the norms given by arbitrary quadratic forms, but all of the symmetric ones. Well, just to see that we're in the right business, let's think a little bit about the lower bound. This computation, I didn't write down enough of the lines of this computation for it to be completely followable, but you'll see what the outline is. Look at the minimum distance for an arbitrary point and that's goofy. That's an error. Obviously, if I took the minimum, the infimum over all x of that right-hand side thing there, then I would get. Well, let's look at that in parse and see how I have to fix it. So, for any x, let's look at the closest sample point to that x. Okay. Oh, that's fine. They're the. Now that infimum just goofed somehow. Let's look at this guy. I think I probably want the supremum of that. It's a problem. Yeah, let's look at this. Oh God, infimums. Let's look at gn of x defined by that thing. Okay. That we certainly do know how to calculate. We did one of these calculations before, and it's no different from any other object. Okay, now if I then integrate up the tail of that one, our idea here is what we want to do is we want to this is actually a calculation we did exactly before and correctly the first time. The bottom line here is what we want to do is we want to estimate min ij minus x, that's over I less than or n, expected value. That's the expected value to an arbitrary point of xi, and this is what I've called gn of x. So if I just made the expectation up there, I bungled the slide, sorry kids. The bottom line is, we now all find ourselves peering out the small window of a dank Portuguese cell, okay? And from this point of view, we say what we'd like to do is provide a lower bound on the minimum matching of endpoints under this norm. Well, we know that the matching contains at least n edges. And the cost of any one of these edges is has got to be of the order of the expected distance between x to a typical random point. I still haven't said that right. Well, I'll write it down better later. The bottom line is that when you do that computation by the same analysis that we did before, you'll find that the one on Dietz root of value of the ball enters in. And just by an elementary argument, you'll be able to show that B of D is at least some small multiple of a power of the volume of the unit ball. So bottom line is that lower bound is easy, but I'm still in the slammer. Okay, this particular outline doesn't do a very good job for us. Okay, now here's the puzzle. How do we get an upper bound? And this is something I was careful about. And the idea is to give a new TSP heuristic. And this is supposed to be a heuristic which is going to be good in high dimensions. So it's not necessarily a heuristic that's good in the low dimensions, but for high dimensions, this should be a good heuristic. Okay. And the process goes like this. Take the high dimensional points and write them in the following way. We write them as a one dimensional and as a d minus one dimension. So the ui's are one dimensional and the y's are d minus one dimensional. Okay. Now we write down the elements of our random sample, and we label them according to the order of their first coordinate, increasing order of their first coordinates. Okay, that gives us a way to decompose them into a set of lists. So in this case, I have 10 points, and I break them into a set of blocks. So I'm going to choose a number of blocks P. So the number of blocks, so I divide it into proportions of size P. So N divided by P, or Q, is the number of blocks I have. So in this case, I end up with 3 blocks of size 3. Okay. And now, what I do is, from the first block to the second block, from this group to that group, I find the best matching that I can. Okay? So the first set of blue arrows with little dots on them. Okay? That's a matching from the points x1, x2, x3 to the points x4, x5, x6. Okay. Now, this is kind of sensible in one coordinate because we chose them, because of the order in which we chose them, the block. It has to be good in all the other coordinates because the matching's a good matching. Okay. So in this matching M1 and M2, what we do is we match where we only count that second set of coordinates. We only match based on the norm applied to the differences in the y's. Okay. Now, all right, given that we've got those matchings, how do we create a tour? Well, first off, I have to give myself a second matching, and matching between the second block and the third block. And those are the blue arrows that have little X's on them. So I'd have a dot, a blue arrow, an X, Y arrow, and that gives me a little chain. And in general, I might have maybe on the order of square root of N chains, or maybe even more, depending upon what value I choose P to be. So I end up with a number of chains. Now, once I've got those chains, I'm pretty well done. I just have to tie those chains together in order to give myself a tour. Okay. Does everybody see how that works? It's kind of interesting. You know, people have been looking at heuristics for the traveling salesman problem for a long time, but this is a new one, and it's not necessarily, and it's completely computationally feasible, and it's not necessarily a good one in low dimensions, but in high dimensions, it's quite a good one. Yeah.
Particular rule with the green arrows
tying together? No, just straightforward. Just by index number, I believe, is all I've done there. But if you took even the worst case matching, it'd be okay because you've only got as many on the order of p of them.
Is Karp's partitioning algorithm
extend
to higher
dimensions
again? Sure. Is that pathetic?
No. Well, you see, the benefit of this heuristic is that this heuristic relates to this. That's a good, very good question because it helps me explain to myself and therefore everybody else what the benefit of this heuristic is. This heuristic relates the TSP to matchings, and then by the result of Talleyrand, we know that we know how to find the right upper constant for the matchings. So it's by throwing, the benefit of this is that it throws all of the energy onto matching constants. If we use the Karp heuristic, we wouldn't worry so much about that, the patching stuff, but the stuff in between, we wouldn't have any relationship to anything that we knew. We would just be relating the constant on the big cube to the constants on the little cubes, and we wouldn't have.
But you'd still get what was that constant?
Yeah, that's right. You'd still get, in terms of the quality of that heuristic, that's right. So in terms of the quality of that heuristic, you would get something, but it wouldn't give you a relationship on the constant. Okay. The competitor to this Well, there we go. So that's the TSP heuristic. And that gives us a crude bound on the cost of that matching. So we've got the cost of Q. Q was N over P floor. We've got Q matchings, or Q minus 1 matchings. Then we've got a crude cost of patching stuff together. There's no reason to be fancier than that. And the issue is to get a good bound on the MIs, one that really takes advantage of the geometry. And with a good bound on the MIs, then we'll pick our P wisely. We leave that hanging there as a parameter until we get good bounds on the MIs. Then pick the P wisely, and that should give us a bound that's good enough to give us the other side of the inequality we need for the TSP constant. Okay. Okay, so the puzzle here, let me put that foil back up. The puzzle here is to get a good bound on the MIs and then choose P to balance the errors, or to have the lead term slightly dominate the errors. And the problem there is that we could use the transportation method. We know that the transportation method does give, that's the method that we used before involving moving things around. We know that that gives the right order of magnitude. But the transportation method, you remember, was definitely built along the principle of splitting and moving rectangles, things that were parallel. Always, all the action was happening with respect to dimensions. That ignores the roundness of the ball, and in high dimensions, that distinction between rectangles and balls starts to become serious. This is, by the way, it turns out that there are no Telegram references in my references, so those are evidently all in a separate file. But this was in Annals of Applied Probability, 1992, Telegram's large D matching theorem. So give ourselves any norm and define the matching as before, and I'm going to give you a couple little lemmas to get us going on this. And the first lemma about this is just the characterization in terms of the dual. Okay, it's not different than we did before. The normalization here is that f of 0 is equal to 0, but that, of course, implies that f of x is less than or equal to 1 for all x. Now, so the first lemma we've seen before. Second lemma, well, we use the result of day one lecture. That's just a Zuma's inequality. Here we're using the fact that if you're Lipschitz, then the change in f can't be any, by changing one value, can't be any more than the diameter, where d here is the diameter, under that norm of 2 points in the unit d cube. And we end up with the Azuma bound. Okay. I have to think for a little while about why you pick up an 8 instead of just a 2, but small potatoes. It's time for a little juggling. Okay. So everybody, it's an opportunity to wake up now. We're going to roll into the harder part of the result, but first you need to do a little juggling. Step zero, tray plane. Step one, one ball from one hand to the other. Not done very well there, but done better there. Step two, hold one ball in the hand and do the same thing. Maybe even the other hand and do the same thing. Step three, two balls in your best hand, one ball in your worst hand. You're going to throw this ball when this ball reaches the apex. Stop. 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 Now, here's actually the culminating step. When this ball, the second ball, reaches the apex, throw the third ball. And that's the unit of, that's the unit, now you just proceed by induction. And if you do that five or six times, then you'll have the pattern. And this is called the basic cascade. Okay. Now, anytime you juggle or show somebody that you can juggle, somebody's going to be inquisitive about the number of balls. That's regarded as bad karma among jugglers. And the truly hip thing is to discuss patterns. That is, patterns other than the cascade. And those, of course, will be left for subsequent lectures. All right. So here's the new idea. And it goes like this. Give yourself a parameter, eta, and normalize the norm so that the ball has volume 1. You can do that by multiplying your norm by a suitable factor. Okay. Then give yourself a small multiple of the characteristic length of the size of your problem. So R is equal to eta into the minus 1 on D. And the volume of the R ball is then given by that ratio. Now, here's a useful function that relates X's and Y's to things that we're pretty good at, things which are statisticians call them U statistics, functions of pairs of things. So we let U, hey, we even used U here, but that was just accident. So this simple U statistic is equal to 1 if the distance between XI and YJ is bounded by R, and we let it be 0 otherwise. And we're going to relate this just elementary numerical function to the matching problem. Let B of X be the volume of the R ball based at X intersecting with the unit D cube. So that's something that we had to worry about very little in two dimensions, but something that requires more worry in higher dimensions. I've indicated the shaded area of the volumes. Because the volume of the whole ball is just eta to the D on N, certainly the value of B of X is bounded this way. So this is a nice, simple, bounded function. Now, the thing that's useful about this is that we can calculate the conditional expectation of UIJ. And the conditional expectation of UIJ given X, if you think about it for a second, that's just the probability that an XJ will fall into the ball determined around XI. But we've already calculated what this probability is. It's just that area, and that's what something we gave the name B of X to, so this is B of XI. And we know that B of XI is bounded by eta to the D on N. Okay. Now we're going to use those guys and relate them to the dual characterization of the matching. Okay. All right. Now here's the calculation that defines our plan. The idea is to start with the object that we have to bound, which is the supremum over all f and g of in the Lipschitz class. And what we want to do is we want to relate that to the UIs. We're going to bring in two sum-ands just by corresponding adding and subtracting. So in these two sum-ands, the sum of the U's are there just by addition and subtraction in the tradition of the great three epsilon proof. The n's, since this is a sum over I, the sum of those just gives us an eta to the d. So the terms that are only there, the ones that weren't just inserted to be canceled away, is the factor eta to the d, which was up there in the top. Okay, so that's an honest inequality. And let's look at it. Turns out that that top term is going to be pretty easy to estimate. We're just going to go at that crudely use the fact, we'll write it as a double sum, see that within that double sum that xi and yj have to be in the same R ball, use the Lipschitz quality of f, and that'll give us a bound. So the first guy is easy, and that sort of tells us why that we were able to slip in the u's for free. The second term is not so easy, but it's got some evidence there that shows us that we should expect some cancellation. Conditioned on xi, these terms should be pretty small. So we're working toward a possibility of a cancellation here. Okay. All right, let's do those. I'm going to run out of material, so at the end I'm going to tell you a proof of the Pythagorean theorem. Actually, a good exercise, which I enjoy doing, there are two exercises that I...
relatively small because we've essentially got cancellation within here. So it would break this into two bits. Both bits are of the same algebraic nature. So if we look at GN, which is the expected value of the supremum over all Lipschitz F, then two of these terms will majorize this guy. And we recall our basic facts. Now, there are two parts to the plan for bounding this GN, each of which are pretty tough. Part one of the plan is, well, let's introduce the simplified notation a little bit when you're using WI, which is the sum over J of that quantity which we're expecting some cancellation. And then we consider a functional for an arbitrary G, which is just like the guy that we're going to feed in up there, except before we take the supremum. So Gn is equal to the supremum of the norm, or the absolute value of the gamma of G. Now, here is an elegant trick. It's a little bit long-winded, but it's part one. Everyone could get out of the Portuguese prison, but no problem. Take G equal to I, the indicator of a set. It's not a Lipschitz function. So it's not really one of the things that we're obligated to figure out how to bound in this case. But it's something that we can bound. So if we take a G and we put it in there, then you've got something which you're pretty well prepared to estimate. If you just use the fact that the L1 norm is bounded by the square root of the, bounded by the square root of the object squared, the expectation of the object squared, then you get to plug in an A there, square it, and do arithmetic. Well, when you do the arithmetic, you're able to show that this object is a genuinely low order. It's not a hard calculation, but it's analogous to lots of other calculations where you get near orthogonality. The kind of two flavors of orthogonality. Part two. Now, this is the piece that I would have. I could have done this first calculation, and I could have gotten the right answer, but then I would have said, but what good is it going to do me to know that it's bound on indicator sets? I've got no way to bootstrap myself up from that to an arbitrary Lipschitz function. Talleyrand does have a good trick for doing that. It will not fit in the margins of this foil there. It's got a couple of pieces to it, and I can explain those pieces. One of the ideas is that if you take the result that you have for indicators and you convolve it with an arbitrary Lipschitz function, then you've got now a result over a certain, then just because convolutions are pleasant operation, you now have the result for a class of functions, a special class of functions, those functions which are representable as a Lipschitz function convolved with an indicator. Now that's not quite the whole class of Lipschitz functions, but it's not so far away. And sort of by a telescoping argument where you telescope over tricks. Well, G equal 1A is easy by squaring and expectorating. Okay, that was the first step. Then you can go from G to let's call it G sub A. G sub A to H star G sub A for H contained in the Lipschitz class by Fubini. one of the reasons that that integrals of convolutions work well is because you have the opportunity when you have the integral of a convolution to do bits of rearranging and reinterpreting. Here you were able to control gamma of 1a. This then gives you control of gamma of h of 1a. Now, take yourself an F, which is in the general Lipschitz class. If you look at F1, which is F minus H1 convolved with F, where H1 is equal to the indicator of, now remember we had the square, we decompose it, this is a little bit different than before, but we look at our characteristic decomposition down to little squares. If I look at F1, which is, you think of, If H1 is a small square, if you compose with a small square, you've got an approximation, then this is approximately equal to F. So that means that that's a small function. Now, if you let F2 be equal to F1 minus H2 involved with H2 is we start off with the smallest convolution, that's H1, and this is H2. Now you have to think a little bit about what the right arithmetic here is. And I'm going to, this is the residual, so if I add in that residual, this will work, but it's not quite what I need. Let's write this one for a second. It's easier to sell but harder to prove.
Okay. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Do you need to normalize the indicator by the measure?
Right. So the indicator would be normalized in such a way as it integrates out the one. So it does. We are convolving with something which is an approximate identity for the small set. So on this residual bit, this is the residual after the approximation of an approximate identity, you have something which is smoother, you have something which is smaller. Do the same trick where we do a less stringent convolution, and then all the way down to the end. Now, at the end, you don't quite have the type of telescoping that you exactly like, but you can add in one highly convolved term, which is therefore very smooth. And since you started out with something that was integrated out to zero, if you take something that integrates to zero and you make it very, very smooth, the only way you can do that is to be very, very close to zero. It gives you a bunch of terms, each of which can be uniformly bounded, and you add those guys up. That's a crude description of that vestigial trick, but it's about the best I can do in that context. All right. So those are the two things that I really intended to do. And I did them less well than I intended, and more quickly than I intended. And so here's a little aperitif. And you can use this in your very own classes.
Is this by induction?
Yeah, this is not by induction. And of course, we're familiar with the relationship that holds for the right triangle. That's what's known as the Pythagorean theorem. Now, if you're given the task of proving the Pythagorean theorem, well, you know how to do it, so it's not as much fun to give you that task as it would be to give the task to a person who didn't know how to do it. doing. But one of the useful things is to think of the natural class of generalizations that contains that theorem. And what this theorem tells us is that if we construct a geometric object on the sides of a right triangle and on the hypotenuse of the right triangle, then the sum of the two areas of the small ones is equal to the area of the third one. So let's look at another example within that class. Suppose you look at semicircles. There I've constructed semicircles. Well, since the relationship between a semicircle and a square of the same diameter is just proportionality by a constant, if I were able to prove the theorem for semicircles, it would imply the theorem for squares. Now, the theorem for semicircles doesn't necessarily look easier. So let's think of the objects which would be the very easiest that they could possibly be. And the easiest object would be triangles. And if we could prove it for triangles, because triangles are proportional to squares, that would suffice to prove it for squares. But for triangles, we see we've made some progress. Because once you write it down for triangles, then you really do see, by elementary similarity, that these two objects have the same area. These two objects have the same area. And that the big gamma has the area of the union. So by similarity of triangles, it's clear that the theorem is true for triangles. Therefore, it is true for semicircles. Therefore, it is true for squares. And that's the Pythagorean theorem. Now, in the domain of circles, lines, and squares, let me tell you how this is at least slightly relevant to the theory of sabbatic Euclidean functionals. So it wasn't a complete red herring. There are tinges of pink to this herring, but it wasn't completely red. Remember that in theory of sabbatic Euclidean functionals, central to the way we thought about things were you partition it into squares, and that gives the scaling on the side of the two squares. Okay, and we've got relationships like L of Q was bounded by, let's write down the expectation, the big thing is Q, one of the little ones is Q1, and we had four of those, E, L, Q1, and then we scale them down by a factor of 1/2 to accommodate for the change in scale, and we got the relationship of E, L, Q, is bounded by 2, E, L, Q, 1. Okay. That's the type of relationship which we use to get things like the asymptotics of the expected value of the TSP. Well, following the paradigm of the Pythagorean theorem, which by the way is in one of Polya's books, either How to Solve It or Induction and Analogy. No reason to just use squares. You just have to find their correct proportionality if you're going to use something other than squares. So let's take an object, say triangles. Let's take a right triangle, isosceles right triangle. If you take an isosceles right triangle, you can cut it into half, and what to your wondering eye should appear but two isosceles right triangles. So if we have LT for the whole triangle in expected value, that's bounded by, well, here we just have two triangles, call it L prime, E, so we've got 2 E L T prime, and we have to change the scale. But the scale of the small triangles in this case, it scales according to area, not according to length. So if we replace that in terms of length, we have to divide by 1 on the square root of 2. So we also have this relationship that ELT, and this is true for any Euclidean functional of the sorts that we've been discussing, ELT primed. And you could have just as well used that relationship to get the asymptotics that we got. Well, I think that I don't know. I can't entertain you anymore.